Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table,
a new United Methodist community of faith taking shape at Central UMC in Sacramento, California.
The podcasts currently feature the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Duhirsu,
with a musical introduction by Anthony Coleman, our director of music.
Thanks for listening. Last week we learned about Sabbath. Matt talked to us all about it, and I want to return to that for a moment as we move from there into considering how we might discover grace in our labor. Remember that Sabbath, as Matt told us, was grounded in an understanding of recognizing our sacred worth, in simply allowing ourselves to be and to soak up God's extravagant love for us. For ancient Hebrews, the Sabbath was also more than a religious observation. Today, we're going to call it kind of what they did in a unique way, a labor strike. I heard that term from my friend Steve Garnes Holmes when he wrote about this some time ago. Let me share it with you. Once a week, the ancient Hebrews laid down their tools and walked off the job, refused to work, refused to contribute to the economic machine of the powerful and the wealthy. A weekly day of rest was unheard of in the ancient world. Rest and leisure was for the ruling wealthy class, not the working class. And it certainly was not for people who were slaves, only for those who were free. Yet the Jews observed it. And as more than a labor negotiating strategy, it was a commandment of God. God desires that people be free and be valued unconditionally for their very existence, not according to the profit they can gain for another. So the Sabbath is a day to relinquish our hold on our earned worth and rest in the grace of God. And it's a day to grant justice to those who labor, to free them from having to earn their keep, and remind us that our economic world exists within the greater world of God's desire for justice. Taking a day off reminds us that our life is more than our work, and our work is more than our job. So tomorrow we celebrate Labor Day, and it's a secular holiday, but it is also an opportunity for Sabbath. It's a day to acknowledge our dependence on those who labor, especially those who labor in the most menial, dirty, dangerous, and dreary jobs, who make a more leisurely life possible for everyone else. It's a day to remember God's demand for justice for those who labor and freedom for those who are in bondage. And it's a day to affirm that in the real world, we do not earn our keep. It's a gift. I want to give us a little bit of history. In case you don't know, we first celebrated Labor Day in 1800s. In 1882, there was a central labor union in Boston, and they helped it become Labor Day, a federal holiday, by 1894. They did this in response to the Pullman Railroad strike between labor unions and railroad owners. There was an ugly conflict in which our government fought the workers, which resulted in deaths of workers striking for better rights and conditions on the railroads. In response, the president of the time, that was Grover Cleveland, moved to bring about reconciliation between the two, the labor union and the railroad owners. Our country has made progress since then in organized labor, and often there's church leadership being part of that progress. And when I say progress, I want to be specific that we now count as benefits and rights, these things for blue and white collar employees. We have value for these things today. Vacations, holidays, workers' compensation, days off, health insurance, disability, unemployment, and collective bargaining. We still have a long way to go, and there are nuances, and as we all know, in all of those areas. But it began back then in the 1800s to shift. And the church, to be confessional, has done our share of sitting on the sidelines and not getting enough involved. But the gospel message, The gospel message is unequivocal and affirms that the intersection of our faith and our moral obligation of justice for all working people is there. And that message came from the life and teaching of Jesus. Labor Day reflects that concern, Jesus' concern, of justice for the poor and the vulnerable. I think it's fair to say that we in this room all know how the teachings of Jesus involved his inclusion of just those folks and those who lived in the margins of our life together. And not unlike the practice of Sabbath, Jesus' teachings were unheard of in his day. He pushed hard on the power structures to include and extend love and hospitality to all. Jesus stood in the tradition of the Hebrew scriptures he knew so well, the tradition that taught him that the widows and the orphans, the landless and those who needed healing mattered to God. So he addressed the disparities between the people of his day, which are echoed in our own day, disparities between income and power. And we know them well. Those with more income hold more power. We encounter this daily, and so did the Hebrews, which is why the writer of our scripture this morning that Matt read was moved to instruct his people in this. They needed to be reminded how to root their lives in grace and grow in faith and to reach in love. In this final chapter of Hebrews, the author is expressing his pastoral concern for his community. And some scholars identify this final chapter kind of as a P.S. of behavioral advice. It seems plausible that the writer who has spent so much time teaching and almost lecturing for the first 12 chapters is able to close it with a succinct do this. I think about it in this way. A lot of times I have three kids and I have a lot to say to them, and I can tell when they gloss over. I can tell when they think I'm lecturing. So at the very end, often what I do is say, "Hey, listen to me. No, I love you. Now go out and know and behave the way a person does when they're loved." That's kind of how this P.S. is. And isn't that true for all of us? That we hear lessons, they go in our heads, but we don't always know what to do. We don't always know how to act. But isn't that what growing in faith is all about? Learning. And learning leads to choices, and choices lead to actions. So, back to this Hebrews passage. Loud and clear are these first four words. Let mutual love continue. Take note, he is saying. This presupposes that mutual love is already being practiced by those who are hearing this text. It says, let it continue, not start now. Such love is not a distant promise, but a reality now available to those very earliest of Christians. And the form of this directive, let love, also strongly suggests that extending this mutual love is how one practices being a Christian, not just occasionally, but regularly, all the time. It was the early church's ability to practice mutual love in the midst of their very hostile pagan environment that prompted one philosopher of the time, Tertullian, to make this observation in his writings. See how these Christians love one another. And it wasn't really necessarily supportive as I read it. It was more like an observation of how strange they are in their letting mutual love continue. The next direction is for an attitude of continual hospitality to strangers. Again, this command is understood within the fold of the whole wider community. With the remarkable system of roads constructed, maintained, and policed by the Roman Empire, travel in the first century was more common and pervasive than we might think. Yet Christians were a small minority. Commercial roadside accommodations were both outlandishly expensive, and they catered to primarily pagan characteristic people of their day, not to Christian characteristic people of the day. So travelers were in need of welcoming hospitality where they could both afford it and feel safe. So holding a spirit of hospitality was a long-held moral tradition, which the author recalls by mentioning that through the practice of common hospitality, Some have even entertained angels. That was the second verse. That tells us that the hearers of this message would have been remembering the experience they knew of Abraham and Sarah welcoming people into their homes. The experience of Gideon in Judges 6, and so on, just to name two. So the directive reminds hearers that just as they have freely received God's grace and mercy, so they should freely give with gestures of hospitality. So how do we know? How do we know who most needs you to reach in love, unless they're knocking on your door and saying, "Do you have a place to stay?" How do we know? Hospitality grows out of the understanding that since we have freely received, then we ought to consider how we might freely give out of this mutual love. Right now, there are so many people that could use our help and need us to reach in love. Women, children, mentally ill folks, homeless folks, our schools, our public schools, our prisons, the streets, under the bridges. The list is endless and overwhelming. And maybe that's part of the problem. Not that we don't understand hospitality and giving and reaching in love, but that there are so many ways that we might help. How do we ever decide? Well, I want to tell you about one woman who made a very firm decision. Her name is Becca Stevens. She's got it figured out for herself because she was confronted with women on the streets in her own community of Nashville, Tennessee. She's the founder of Thistle Farms, and she decided just who needed her to reach in love. Let's watch this video. I want to lift up two of the things she said. No woman went to the streets by herself. It took a community, a broken community, to help her get there. And it's going to take a whole community to help her come off the streets, too. And then this. All of us learn more from mercy than we do from judgment. All of us learn from being loved and from feeling like we are lovable. If we want to follow Jesus, we have decisions to make. And one of them is, to whom will I reach in love? Another is, am I going to allow God to love me unconditionally? We too must go on strike and rest in the grace of God loving us, the grace that is freely received. And that is where we get the energy to freely give. So some of us made a decision to reach to the Mustard Seed School, and you see all of these backpacks piled on the altar behind me. We see the results right here in front of us. Who's going to be next? Who needs our mutual love? The way we found out about Mustard Seed School was from two of us, Megan and her daughter Bailey, and they found out that the children needed help. And so they lifted that up, and they led all of us. And it only took 3-4 weeks to gather all of these materials. And we know they're going to be delivered this week. And these backpacks will be full of supplies back and forth from the shelter to the school, and hopefully eventually from a home to the school. So who is next? Who among us will stand up and say, I know what we need to do? Or who among us will just do it in their own work life? I want to close with these words, again from my friend Steve Garnes Holmes. Whether or not tomorrow is a day off for you, remember on Labor Day, those who labor, especially those who receive no rest. Give thanks for those who pick your fruit, mine your coal, and make your clothes. Pray and work for the day that the rich do not oppress the poor, and the poor are not indentured to the powerful for their survival. And give thanks for the gift that without having earned it, you are beloved. And because of that, you are able to lovingly reach in love to others. Amen.
The sun will rise, the sun will rise, bringing life to the earth as it springs from the ground. The sun will rise, the sun will rise, we will dry all our tears, lay your burdens down. We will dry all your tears, lay your burdens down.